it can be extremely, extremely challenging. It'd be naive of me to say I think that we're always going to have 100% success if we are dealing with these well-entrenched beliefs and trying to navigate that.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Ignite 2023 Conference Conversations Podcasts, Series 4, brought to you by the Physiotherapy Research Foundation, supporting the promotion and translation of research. Let's get started.
Hi, everyone. My name is Josh, and I'm here with Yanvi and Travis. And today we're going to be looking at the effects of language and labels on people's beliefs about musculoskeletal pain. Before I start, we'd like to acknowledge the Turrbal and Yugara peoples of Meanjin as the original owners and custodians of the lands on which we meet, work and learn. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. So I thought we'd start by just giving a brief introduction of who we are. So my name's Josh Sadro. I'm a research fellow at the University of Sydney, working at the Institute for Musculoskeletal Health. And I have a physiotherapy background, worked in private practice for a few years and with sports teams. Now I'm a full-time researcher. And in terms of research interests, my main focus is looking at ways to improve access to effective and affordable care, particularly as that relates to physiotherapy interventions. So I might pass over to Yanfei to introduce herself.
Hello, my name is Yanfei Xiet. I'm a postdoc research fellow at the Recover Injury Research Centers at the University of Queensland. I'm also a physio by background. I have worked in public hospitals before I jumped into the research field. So currently now I'm full-time research. So my research mainly focuses on understanding the mechanisms of musculoskeletal pains and also developing and implementing effective and tailored treatments. Particularly, we focus on neck pain after road traffic injuries.
Thanks, Yanfi, and we'll pass over to Travis.
Yeah, I'm Travis. So I'm a PhD candidate. I'm in the last few months of my PhD studies, and I've been looking at basically how people's beliefs about hip pain in middle-aged and older adults influences the type of treatments that they think might be helpful and the type of care that they seek out. I'm also a physiotherapist as well. I've worked primarily in private practice, and I do some teaching with the University of Melbourne as well in the Doctor of Physiotherapy program. And I don't know if I mentioned, but I'm with the Centre of Health, Exercise, Sports Medicine as part of my PhD.
Thanks, Travis. Okay, so today I guess we're all here to talk about studies that we've recently done looking at the effects of labels on management strategies for musculoskeletal pain. But I thought it'd be good to start with a brief look into how labels came into the MSK field, because this is more of a recent movement that's been happening. For many years, there was kind of speculation that the labels people use for different musculoskeletal conditions may increase their fear and anxiety and push them towards more invasive treatments. But there was no real empirical evidence to support this. And so when we looked at other fields, we found a lot of research in medicine, which showed that if you give people a more medicalized diagnosis for a range of conditions like breast cancer, polycystic ovary syndrome, conjunctivitis and gastroesophageal reflux, they were more likely to choose tests and treatments that have no supporting evidence. And even when they were told that these treatments are not necessary, these labels would still push them towards choosing these compared to ones that were less medicalized and described more the prognosis rather than a specific structure that was the problem. And so with this, me and my research group, we thought it would be interesting to investigate this for musculoskeletal conditions where we can't figure out the exact nociceptive cause of pain. And the example that we've done a bit of research on is rotator cuff related shoulder pain, which is basically a umbrella diagnosis that captures a range of conditions affecting the shoulder. And it's the most common presentation that people will see in the clinic. And so this diagnosis comes by many different labels. So some call it rotator cuff related shoulder pain, and others call it subacromial pain syndrome, impingement syndrome, rotator cuff disease. And because imaging findings and clinical examination findings aren't reliable enough to tell us the exact cause of the pain, people tend to use a range of labels to suit their context. Sometimes people call it a tear, a bursitis, or give it a more generalized label, such as rotator cuff-related shoulder pain. And so we thought, could we see which one of those labels helps patients choose more evidence-based treatment options and avoids the need for low-value care such as surgery or imaging? And so that brings us to the first study we did, which looked at this in people with shoulder pain. So we conducted an online randomized experiment where people with shoulder pain read a hypothetical scenario describing a case of rotator cuff-related shoulder pain. Then at the end of the scenario, a health professional would give them a label, and then they would see how much the patient thought that they needed surgery or other interventions. And what we found was that if you label people with bursitis, this was the label that reduced people's perceived need for surgery the most compared to rotator cuff tear. And it also reduced perceived need for imaging compared to rotator cuff tear and subacromial impingement syndrome. And so this was the first quantitative study to look at this. It was also replicated in the back pain field, where people found that if you call non-specific back pain a disc bulge, disc herniation, or arthritis, then it's going to increase their need for imaging and surgery compared to more non-specific labels, such as non-specific back pain and lumbar sprain. So that's a brief overview of, I guess, my work, but I might pass over to maybe Travis first to go over what he found in his study.
So yeah, we looked at a similar type of thing. It was based on, you know, some of that existing literature as well, that a patho-anatomic or a biomedical approach to communication might influence people to be, you know, wanting more invasive or surgical care. So what we did, we were looking at hip pain, and it sort of, this came from a review as well that we did that actually found diagnostic information from healthcare professionals. So all those findings coming from x-rays and scans, one of the key things that was influencing people's beliefs. And, you know, as we know from broader qualitative literature as well, the dominant or prevailing understanding of wear and of osteoarthritis or hip pain is one of wear and tear and degeneration. So what we wanted to do was test that in an experimental study. So we had three groups, three labels with an explanation. One, our label, sort of almost like a control label, was hip degeneration. And that took on that wear and tear language or understanding, you know, that we found, like I said, was prevailing discourse around hip pain. Use language like bone on bone, it's an inevitable aspect of aging. Then we took hip osteoarthritis as our second label. So this is, you know, probably the medical label, which I would say is most used among healthcare professionals. But we did find in our review and qualitative literature that some people still attach negative emotions and concern to that label. So we wanted to test that. But what we did was we attached more of a contemporary understanding of hip osteoarthritis to that label as an explanation, just to see if, you know, see how that would affect people's beliefs basically about hip osteoarthritis as well. So rather than describing it as something like wear and tear, we described it as, you know, that imbalance actually between, you know, body's changes and the repair processes over time. And then lastly, we wanted to provide them with basically a biopsychosocial explanation of hip pain that took away any or didn't emphasize structural pathology. So that was a persistent hip pain label. And in that persistent hip pain label, as the explanation, we did acknowledge things like, you know, it can be due to changes in the hip, but also things like sleep, emotions, stress, fear, things of that nature. So we compared those, randomized, you know, about 600 people to each of those groups, and we looked for effects on beliefs about hip pain management. Our primary outcomes were surgery and exercise harmfulness. And yeah, indeed, we found that we saw between group differences between both the hip OA persistent hip pain label with that degeneration hip pain label, that wear and tear explanation, and also across a lot of our secondary outcomes, for example, perceived helpfulness of physiotherapy, which again was higher in that hip OA label with that contemporary explanation and the persistent hip pain label with the psychosocial explanation.
And I noticed you found quite large effects for this study. And so I guess how important are these effects for clinicians, and what would you recommend coming off the back of that?
Knowing the clinical importance of these outcomes is difficult because we haven't done that research. So it's definitely a limitation of it. But given these are sort of 10 to 20% changes on baseline, which is pretty comparable with other, what we'd say, clinically important differences for other outcomes on a 0 to 11 NRS, you know, you might reason through that some of these changes would be clinically worthwhile. But I think the broader take-home message here for clinicians is, in some ways, it's difficult to change our language because it's quite entrenched, but in other ways, it's an extremely low-cost intervention. And given we are seeing differences in something like 2 points on NRS scale for perceived need of surgery, and just given the societal implications and costs associated with overuse of surgery, you know, on people with hip pain, middle-aged and older adults, I think the benefits certainly outweigh, you know, the perceived difficulty or cost associated with changing the language we use to start diagnosing and explaining hip pain.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, Travis. And Yanfei, do you want to walk through your study and what you found?
Yeah, sure. We started this study because there has been a lot of discussions changing the names for neck pain after road traffic injury. So Usually, when people experience neck pains after road traffic injuries, it's often caused whiplash injuries or whiplash-associated disorders. So in the field, lots of researchers and clinicians find that this might not be appropriate labels, but we are thinking to change this. But we firstly, we thought that we need to find out if we change it, what labels we're going to use and whether it is worth to change it. So that's how we start these studies. And this study is actually inspired by Josh, your shoulder studies. So we use similar study designs and online randomized experimental studies. So participants are randomly allocated to read one of the five hypothetical scenarios describing neck pain after road traffic injuries. So the only differences between the scenarios was the labels that health professionals use to describe neck pains. So the labels that we included are whiplash injuries, whiplash associated disorders, post-traumatic neck pain, neck pain and neck strain. So our primary outcomes is different from George's studies and Travis' studies. So we focus on recovery expectation as the primary outcomes because, you know, previous research found that recovery expectation is an important predictor in terms of how well people will recover after road traffic injuries. And there's not, you know, many people will choose for the surgeries if they have neck pain after road traffic crash. So that's why we focus on recovery expectation as the primary outcomes. We also have several secondary outcomes, including the needs for imaging, needs for second opinions, intensive treatments, needs for avoiding physical activities, and anxiety about the given diagnosis as well. So what we found is that overall, we found that the labels whiplash associated disorders and neck pain led to lower recovery expectations compared to the label neck strain. So this is the overall findings. So in addition to the main labeling effect, we also found that the influence of the labels on recovery expectations varies depending on whether participants have previous or currently neck pain or not. So we found that among participants with no history of neck pains, like the labels whiplash associated disorders led to lower recovery expectations compared to the labels whiplash injuries and neck strain. So this is quite interesting because among those who are not familiar with neck pains, the label whiplash associated disorders actually led to lower recovery expectation compared to whiplash injuries. So we thought that maybe it's not the term whiplash caused the problems, maybe the term disorders made people think that they are, you know, slower to recover. And then among participants who previously experienced or currently experienced neck pain when they do these studies, we found that the label neck pains actually led to lower recovery expectations compared to the label neck strain. So this is also interesting as well because this may be due to the fact that among those who are already familiar with neck pains, they may be seeking understanding of the exact cause behind the conditions. So when they hear the diagnostic label neck pains, they might think this is too general. It doesn't pinpoint to anything, so it doesn't tell them what exactly caused their neck pain. So they might feel dismissed and might feel that the healthcare provider did not know what exactly happened to them. So probably this mistrust led to the belief of lower recovery expectations. And this also reflects on the qualitative past that we collected from the participants as well.
So I want to ask you about the clinical importance of your findings. Before I do, I might summarize the overall direction of the different studies and labels. So there's been four conditions that have been investigated, looking at the effect of labels on management intentions. And the two ones with the biggest effects are in hip pain and low back pain. So they found generally that clinicians should avoid labels like hip degeneration for people with hip pain, and for back pain, people should avoid labels of disc bulge, disc degeneration, and arthritis. Our research in the shoulder, we found smaller effects and to avoid rotator cuff tear and subacromial impingement syndrome. And we found that the effects of giving good advice was additive to this, but it was a lot bigger. So it was around 2 to 3 times bigger. For those three conditions, the clinical implications seem to be that clinicians should still avoid those labels because it's low risk, effort, and cost. But for whiplash, it seems more complicated because we've got compensable patients and also small effect sizes. So, Yanfi, would you like to talk me through, I guess, what your opinion is on the clinical importance of these findings and maybe why it's a bit more complicated in a compensable environment?
I think, yes, definitely the whiplash space is a little bit complicated, and the results of our study is not straightforward, that, you know, one label is definitely expect compared to other labels. And then I guess the effect size we found is also small, like only like for recovery expectations, the differences between labels is only 0.5 on the scale from 0 to 10. So we are not sure about the clinical relevance of this finding. So we are not sure whether it is acceptable for clinicians and the insurance regulators to change the labels. And if we change, like what labels that will be appropriate. So among five labels that we find, next strain seems to be the best ones. But even for this one, some participants still feel that this one is not suit for everyone. So we have qualitative results, like preliminaries. So we are still finalizing the analysis. So I remember one of the participants cooked that they don't believe that they will recover, completely recover after 3 months, because they feel next strain is a wishy-washy diagnosis. So they don't trust the healthcare providers. I feel like there's no one label that can satisfy to all peoples. And whiplash has been here for a long time. So I'm not sure whether it's easier to change. If we want to ask people to change the label, whether it's easier for everyone to make the change. But I think it is definitely important for the clinicians to be aware that the language that we use to describe, you know, musculoskeletal pain or neck pain after road traffic injuries can influence what people think about dance and what they do with them. We also found that the labels like whiplash associated disorder and whiplash injuries can led to higher perception of the need to avoid physical activities compared to neck strain. So we don't want this happens because we know that physical activities is important for to help people recover in the future. So I guess it might be more important, like when we see the patients, it might be important to ask the patients about what the label means to them, like their understanding about the labels and what the label means to their individual prognosis and how they think about the conditions. And then if we see some misconceptions among, you know, the patients, it's important that we clearly explain the diagnostic label and address the misconceptions related to the labels. I think that might be more acceptable among clinicians and regulators, the insurance regulators and the patients. Because for in compensation areas, they need to have something to record in the papers in terms of people's conditions. So if you ask them to change the labels, I'm not sure whether it will create chaos or something like that. So I guess we definitely, if we are looking to change the label, we definitely need to see opinions discussed with all of the stakeholders to sort their thoughts in terms of we found these small differences, like what do you think? Do you think we should change the label or whether there are other ways to better tell the patients, like explain the labels to the patients to avoid patients to have negative thoughts about the conditions and promote good value care.
Yeah, that's very interesting because it kind of brings up the issue which is relevant to the other fields of research and labeling, and that is what do we do when they've already received a label from another health professional? And maybe I'll pass it over to Travis to say, if you're in the clinic and someone's already received a diagnosis from someone else of hip degeneration, and that's what they present to you with, what would you recommend clinicians do?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think this comes back to a little bit of that conversation before around maybe some of the differences in the size of effects on beliefs as well. I do think maybe that pays to some extent is due to that well-entrenched societal belief that if you have hip OA, you need surgery, and just that very common, you know, sort of societal belief around is due to degeneration and wear and tear. So I think that in some ways, you know, explains why that wear and tear degeneration label did have such a large effect on beliefs about things like the potential damage from exercise or, you know, the need to see an orthopedic surgeon. So I think the first thing to acknowledge is, you know, probably if you are in the clinic like myself, most people that come to you with knee or hip pain, if they're over 55, 60, probably do think that they have some type of wear and tear or, you know, a degeneration type issue. Interestingly, though, based on our experimental data from our trial, we didn't actually find a moderating effect from people that had sought healthcare or not, that actually had hip pain. So there might actually be some scope there based on, you know, at least those data alone, that there might be some room to still shift or work with those existing beliefs. And just to extend on that a little bit more, and this is probably where I'm getting a little bit better understanding about this issue, is we're also doing qualitative interviews now as well. So we're taking people, some people at least, that have these existing understanding about what their pain is, which is usually a wear and tear one, like I've said. Often that is coming from healthcare professionals, but not always. You know, these types of things also come from observing neighbors with similar issues, discussions around the water cooler, all that type of stuff. And, you know, I'm putting this information to people and asking them, what do you think about it? You know, this is to people, like I said, who think their hip pain is due to degeneration. And it's just really mixed. It's really mixed, and some people have a very sticky, well-entrenched belief. And no matter what information I present to them, they still view it through that lens of seeing their hip pain as wear and tear. And somehow that information, no matter what it is, gets turned back into, oh, this is going to be an inevitable part of aging. I'm going to need surgery, sort of lacking hope around their potential improvement. But for other people, they're extremely receptive to it as well. So they might have that existing understanding, but they're really open to this idea that other contributing factors could be playing into that, particularly if they can intuit themselves experiences that they've had or things that they've come to realize in their own life, whereby they've noticed that, oh, their pain actually gets a little bit better when they're with their friends, or their pain gets a little bit better when they've slept a little bit better, and drawing on their own experiences rather than me having to sit there didactically and lecture them about these things. If I can get those experiences out of those people and get them to realize themselves these types of things that might actually be influencing their pain, that maybe contradict or challenge their existing beliefs around it is just this inevitable age and tear, bone on bone. You know, that seems to be where I see the biggest scope to shift. I'd say most people are open to that discussion. But, you know, I know in the clinic myself, and I know having spoken to people in depth now, that it can be extremely, extremely challenging. It'd be naive of me to say, I think that we're always going to have 100% success if we are dealing with these well-entrenched beliefs and trying to navigate that. Last final thing I'll say is you need to understand where these beliefs come from. And that's probably the biggest thing I'm coming to learn now, is that obviously a lot of things goes into informing beliefs, but it's the more you unpack it, the more you realize the richness and depth that goes into these things. It's not just what healthcare professionals tell people. That's a big part of it. Findings, x-ray findings. But like I said, it's what they've observed from their neighbor, what experiences their mum might have had of joint pain, what they've seen on TV, Google, Dr. Google's a huge one, YouTube, more increasingly, Twitter. It's extremely complex, and unpacking that might also be important in the clinic as well. Just understand where people are coming from.
Yeah, I think that's great. And that mode of thinking kind of inspired the second study that we did in the field of labeling. So the first one, we found an isolated effect of labels, saying bursitis is the label that helps patients choose more evidence-based options and rotator cuff tear isn't. But then we got a lot of comments from Twitter and the community saying that we only had everyone receive guideline-based advice. And so the reason we chose good advice in that study was we wanted to see, even if people get the right advice from a health professional, does the label have an independent effect? And then people were saying, if in the real world scenario, not everyone gives good advice, and some people give advice that's going to increase fears and make them a lot more likely to choose non-evidence-based treatment options. And so really the question was, is the effect of labels and advice, which one's bigger? And so that led us to look at the effect of giving guideline-based advice versus a recommendation for treatment, and comparing that to the effect of labeling as bursitis and rotator cuff tear. And we found that the advice was a lot more important, but they both still had their independent effects. So even if there's cases where you can give good advice, it's still important to also give a good label as well. I think it helps those scenarios when someone's already been given a label and it's very hard to change those entrenched beliefs that this is the diagnosis. But then I think in those cases, you can look to the research and say, well, the advice probably matters a bit more than that. So even though I can't change the label that they've received, I can change the meaning that they attach to that label through some good advice and suggesting some evidence-based treatment options. Another question I think would be interesting is, maybe I'll ask Travis first, do you think labeling would change based on whether someone presents with an acute or chronic condition? I know Yanfis was in whiplash, so they're all very acute patients, but it'd be interesting for hip pain. Do you think labels have more or less of a role when someone's presenting with acute pain versus a condition they've had for a long time?
Yeah, I would say so. So we do, the people that we've included in our research are all people that have had pain for 3 months or longer. So yeah, just to say that all of our data is coming out of our population that, you know, would, it's a bit of a, you know, wishy-washy definition, but would have persistent hip pain based on that. Yeah. So most definitely I would expect that potentially if someone is coming to you with an acute bout of pain, particular, depends on their background, they probably aren't expecting you to give them a label of something like degeneration or hip osteoarthritis, particularly if that pain maybe isn't as severe, you know, something like persistent hip pain or hip strain, which we haven't tested, but, you know, based on both of your research, that might be a little bit more palatable for that type of person. But again, it would probably be based on their own experiences and existing beliefs. Like, you know, if they thought for whatever reason that, you know, they had had some wear and tear because of, you know, X, Y, and Z, then maybe they still would be expecting that more traditional persistent hip pain diagnosis, like a hip OA or hip degeneration or arthritis.
Yeah, it does all come back down to expectations, doesn't it? Yeah. How they present to you in the clinic.
100%. I think, well, at least something I do, and I'm not saying this is the gold standard approach, is, you know, the first question, you know, what do you think the problem is, or what's your understanding of the issue? And not everyone will have a coherent or strong belief around that, but often people do. And I think the less you can say to begin with and insert yourself, the more you can just try and understand where someone's coming from, the better. And that first 3 minutes, 4 minutes might be vital, and just to getting an understanding of what that person is actually expecting. Because like I said, you know, a lot of people weren't particularly satisfied with the persistent hip pain label, but some were. And even in interviewing people now, some are, even though they have persistent hip pain, you know, and based on other people are more expecting that hip OA type technical explanation, some are totally fine with a persistent hip pain diagnosis and were totally satisfied with that as an explanation for their pain. So there's no one, you know, size fits all. And if you can understand the person in front of you, I think you'd be much better positioned to give them the type of diagnosis that A, they'll be satisfied with, but B, that will hopefully most favorably start to influence their beliefs about things we, you know, recommended treatments, exercise, physical activity, those types of things.
And I think that's where the research and clinical practice intersect, because we're talking about trials where we're trying to isolate the effect of a label and we're getting an effect size, which is based on averages. But when you get to the clinic, it's very different and you have to make a decision as to which patient would be more inclined to accept a certain label. So there's a bit of integration between the evidence and what people are doing in practice. I might wrap up with one more question about the research from here. So maybe Yanfi, I'll ask you. So where's the next step in research related to labeling for whiplash going?
The next step, we actually think that this might not worth the resource to actually change the names. And then we are not sure if we change the name, what exactly labels that can satisfy all people. So I guess the next step for in terms of labels and language, maybe it's like not specific to whiplash, but one of the thoughts I was thinking is that it would be important to, like, language and communication skill, definitely important among health professionals in managing musculoskeletal pain. So it would be important to come up with, like, or demonstrate whether some strategies or communication strategies will help to reduce some of the unhelpful beliefs or empower people to engage with more evidence-based care.
And Travis, future research directions for labeling and hip pain?
Yeah, so I was sort of hoping by talking to some people, unpacking what we found in terms of those effects on beliefs, I might get somewhere closer to coming up with an alternative for that wear and tear way of explaining pain, because I sort of feel like we know not what to do, but what's the good alternative there? What's going to be palatable for, you know, the general public in terms of giving them, you know, a compelling, coherent explanation of their pain that they're satisfied with, that would hopefully start, you know, suggesting to them that things like exercise would be helpful and, you know, that they don't necessarily need surgery. I'm coming to realize that that's going to be more difficult than I thought. I was probably very naive thinking I'd get there in a few years. Yeah, I get a much better understanding now that the way people interpret this information is obviously, and you know, is an obvious point in hindsight, is going to very much be influenced the types of beliefs and mindset that they're bringing onto that. It's not just saying that it's impossible task of finding that satisfactory explanation that doesn't lean on things like wear and tear degeneration, but I think there is going to be an individual, you know, or a tailoring of that information required. But we are finding that certainly some terms and approaches are opening people up to that. And I think that's what needs to be explored more moving forward. This idea of repair does seem to suggest to people, and you know, based at least based on its early findings, that there might be some scope to actually improve things, but we just need to work out how best to shape that language and implement it into practice. And then the final two things I'll say is we need to work out, like some of the work that you've been doing, how these things work, either, you know, independently but with advice, or whether or not they actually interact. I know you didn't find that, but it would be interesting to explore that in this space. Oh, and then lastly, the main thing is, how do these things actually implement the things that matter? Beliefs, okay, they're important, but what we really care about is behavior. You know, are people actually doing more, moving more, exercising more? Are surgery referral rates or surgery rates coming down? You know, if we can start to implement this thing in the clinic. So yeah, difficult research, but if we could actually get to that and answer that question, I think that would put, you know, would be excellent. That's what I'd be most interested in.
Yeah, and I think I agree with those two research avenues. I think talking to clinicians and understanding what is acceptable in terms of labeling for them, what are they willing to label these conditions for? Would they give it to everyone that comes through the clinic? And then also some research conducted in the real world setting where we get patient outcomes. We see what labeling does to people's pain and function, but also what it actually does to their healthcare choices later down the track. I think that's the next important things in the field. And maybe the last thing we'll do is go around and just say some key takeaways for the clinicians listening to this. So what would be your main suggestion going into the clinic next week, Yanfi?
I think my main message is that although we find small differences and we don't know the clinical relevance, but I think we should be aware of, you know, what we tell patients and the language that we use do have some influence on the patient's beliefs and how they would like to manage the condition. So I think it would be important to, you know, firstly check their understanding about the diagnostic labels that they received, and then check what that means to their own recovery. And if we find any, you know, misconceptions or unhelpful beliefs attached to the labels, make sure that we address it. I think that's the key take-home message that I would find from my own research and from the other research in this area as well.
My most confident recommendation would be, you're dealing with people, middle-aged or adult with hip pain, you know, you really start to move away from describing and labeling that condition as wear and tear, bone on bone degeneration. Based on, you know, qualitative and quantitative data now, pretty confident that's not having, you know, favorable effects on the types of things that people will think will be helpful. Unfortunately, I don't have a recipe from there to say what to do, but I would say opening that idea up of a more contemporary understanding of HIPAA does seem to be helpful in terms of people thinking things like exercise could be helpful. So yeah, you could engage with some resources around there. And then finally, in a very tailored person-centered way, start exploring what psychosocial factors could be relevant for them, whether that's sleep or stress, emotions, and then opening that conversation up then about how that could actually be contributing to their pain, which then does seem to provide a platform to be offering or increasing the receptiveness to psychosocial treatments, you know, as relevant or needed for that person.
And if someone's coming into the clinic with shoulder pain, the most, I guess, the simple things you can do is avoid labels of rotator cuff tear and subacromial impingement syndrome. If a patient's already got the labels, then I think it's worth exploring what they believe about these labels and what they think it means for their condition, and potentially addressing any misconceptions they have about what that means for their management and prognosis of the condition. And then I think we've also shown that the effect of advice is stronger than the effect of labels. So if you can also provide guideline-based advice, which is explaining shoulder pain in terms of a non-serious pathology, giving a positive outlook on the condition and recommending simple self-management strategies, then I think that's probably the best we can do at this stage regarding this field of work. Thanks everyone for joining. Thanks Jan for you. Thanks Travis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to another episode of Conference Conversations, brought to you by the Physiotherapy Research Foundation. Make sure you catch the next episode in the Conference Conversations podcast series. Thanks for listening.